We have a couple of articles tonight about significant theater figures. Also, the jazz and pop at the fairgrounds are not the only musical choices this weekend. Stay with us, you'll see. I'm Jack Hopke. Hi there once again. First, this evening, there's a lot of juicy material for an actor in Tennessee Williams' Streetcar Named Desire. Sex, booze, class distinctions, betrayal, all set in the seething French Quarter of 1940s New Orleans. A new revival has added yet another set of layers to the play. Very recently, a multiracial production of Streetcar opened on Broadway, starring Blair Underwood in one of the most iconic roles in American theater, that, of course, of Stanley Kowalski. Underwood joined NPR's Scott Simon to discuss the Broadway revival.
Quite a way to make your Broadway debut, Stanley, isn't it?
It is indeed. Although I started being on stage when I was 15 years old, and every opportunity I have, I get back to the theater, but never at this address on the Broadway stage.
So how do you play Stanley as an African-American man in 1940s New Orleans?
How I play Stanley is how I wake up every day as an African-American man. I start with my heart. I start with my humanity. I start with my soul. The script is exactly what Tennessee Williams wrote, and it's astounding how it resonates in a unique way, coming from actors who have a certain cultural alignment. There are very minor things. I mean, you mentioned Stanley Kowalski. We got the permission from the Tennessee Williams estate to just not use the last name Kowalski because obviously I'm not Polish. Mm-hmm. And then one other reference where Stanley and Stella go out to a restaurant called Galatoire's in Tennessee Williams' script. Well, Galatoire's in the 1940s was a segregated restaurant, so we changed that to a place called Dookie Chase, which was a famous restaurant then in the 40s and is still in existence today, that was integrated.
How do you handle the divided nature in Stanley? On the one hand, he's electric and magnetic and lovable. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he's abusive and even cruel.
I see him very much as a man-child. The child, I see, is a very petulant, kind of spoiled brat who wants what he wants, when he wants it, and how he wants it. And the man side is the aspects and the characteristics most people think of and point to, and that's the brutality and the animalistic side of him.
Not once did you put a wool over this boy's eyes. You come in here and you sprinkle the place with powder and spray perfume and cover the light bulb with a paper lantern, and lo and behold, the place is turning into Egypt, and you are the queen of the Nile sitting on your throne and swilling down my liquor.
It's exciting to put that cloak on every day, that cloak that is Stanley.
At the heart of the story, of course, is Blanche DuBois.
Yes.
From Laurel, Mississippi, arrives to visit her sister in New Orleans. The DuBois were once people of means, but no more.
Yes.
And I was fascinated to read you kind of made a discovery in your own family history that brings you a little closer to this story.
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. I recently did a show for NBC called Who Do You Think You Are? And it's a show where you trace your ancestors. And what I learned in my own family was that my four times great-grandfather, Samuel Scott, was a free person of color in the early 1800s, Virginia South, who owned 200 acres of land. But in this story, it is wholly consistent to have the DuBois sisters be free people of color. Now, the free people of color were more probably prominent in the New Orleans South, in Louisiana. But it's fascinating because with an African-American cast, if you know the South, you know that it's authentic and historically accurate. We've just never seen it this way on Broadway. And I did want to mention, you know, Tennessee Williams sanctioned many productions of color throughout the years. I mean, the earliest production of color with an African-American cast was 1955 in Los Angeles, starring James Edwards. And Tennessee Williams sanctioned that then. And he and his estate later have done just that all over the country for all of these years. But this happens to be the first time it's ever been done on Broadway.
So he didn't think it was any kind of a casting gimmick. He thought it had a resonance in the story.
No, and that's what's exciting because he knew the French Quarter. If you know New Orleans, you know it's such a gumbo of all cultures, French and the Spanish and the African and, you know, that whole European influence and Caribbean influence. It's one of my favorite places on the planet.
When you play Stanley, you have to utter what might be the most famous one-word cry from the heart in American theater.
Hey, Stella!
It's a precarious area to step into because you're right. It is one of the most iconic moments, not only in film, but on the stage, in the Broadway stage. So it is a cry from the heart. And as long as it's connected to that desperation and the depth of pain and loss in that moment and fear, because, you know, this happens right after he's beaten his wife Stella, who is pregnant, and she walks out on him. And you can gather that it's more than likely happened before. And there's probably a conversation in the backstory where she said, if it happens again, I'm leaving you. So that heightens the stakes in terms of his desperate cry from the heart.
Stella! Stella!
My job is to make it as honest and as grounded as possible, and the audience will bring what they bring to it. So you just have to do, you know, commit and let the comparison and the chips fall where they may.
When a performance is over at night, do you like Stanley?
I do. I love this guy. You know, so much of his acting out is because of his happy life that he had with his wife Stella, that is altered and obliterated when her sister, his sister-in-law, Blanche DuBois, comes to live with them. So there is a certain inherent understanding of, well, I kind of see how he'd be upset. So that said, I do love Stanley because I see his flaws and I see how he wants to make it right.
Mr. Underwood, thanks so much.
Oh, Scott, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the time.
That was actor Blair Underwood here on All Things New Orleans, speaking with Weekend Edition's Scott Simon about his role as Stanley in A Streetcar Named Desire, the play currently being performed at the Broadhurst Theater on Broadway and is scheduled to run through July 22nd. Jack Hopke with you for All Things New Orleans on this 3rd of May. Don't forget, if you tune in later, you miss any of our features this evening, they're always archived for your access at WWNO.org. Let's change art forms just a little bit now. People around the world know Therese Anderson for the one-woman performance she crafted during the success of her last record called Hummingbird Go. But now the Swedish-born musician is giving us an entirely new set of reasons to listen. On this week's Notes from New Orleans, next, Therese joins Sharon Litwin to discuss a new record and a new performance, and a new baby.
We all know there's a certain rhythm to New Orleans. Sometimes it's hard to explain, especially to people not from here. But there are those who get it, no matter where they're from. Some come to soak up the sounds, mostly the music, to check out the architecture, to bask in the lushness of the environment, and then they leave. But others, captured by the exotic quality of this strange place, stay.
I came to New Orleans for music and love, and I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. Traveling from Gotland, which is an island in the Baltic Sea, which is where I grew up, way out in the country, which is probably as far away from New Orleans as you can get, I got on a plane one January day and moved to New Orleans. It was a culture shock.
That's Swedish import Therese Anderson, who in 1990 at age 18 moved to New Orleans with her at the time musician boyfriend. Much has happened since then. That relationship ended. She went on to perform with a number of other bands. She left New Orleans for a while, then returned to create her own kind of music with its roots in the rhythm of the city.
The fact that I landed in New Orleans has really shaped me as a musician. It has taught me to become a performer. Because here we have performers. There's incredible performers here. There are great entertainers. And I've learned from being around that. And also being good on your instrument, being able to improvise, being able to... This is a city by a river, so we have a lot of water. There's a lot of flow here. And in the music, there's a lot of flow as well, if you will. There's a lot of improvisation and a lot of sort of floating around each other. And that's something I've really picked up. I think also the rhythmical element of New Orleans, which is very, very strong, is something that has also put a mark in how I approach music and how I write.
Rising.
the years, Teresa carved out a unique type of one-woman performance that blended electronic effects with her unique voice. Since it was hard to describe how she did that, in 2008 she made a YouTube video which, more than a million views later, helped to establish her as a creative rising star. Now she's into the next phase of her life. Married to New Orleans theater producer and puppet maker Arthur Mintz, with a baby daughter and a new record out, she's figuring out her own life rhythm.
I made the record, and now I'm actually on the road. I've been on the road with my daughter since she was 6 months old. And we try to travel as a family. My husband comes along as much as possible. And then when I'm in Europe, my mother will come along to help out. So we're keeping it within the family as much as possible. And it's so far, it's working out really good. And I think for us, we can see ourselves doing this at least till Elsie needs to start going to school.
In the meantime, there's lots of singing and lots of recording going on and, of course, an appearance at the Jazz Fest.
Well, this year for my Jazz Fest performance, which is going to be on Friday, May 4th, I'm going to do something that's been pretty unusual for me the past few years as I've been performing solo all the time doing my one-woman show. I'm actually going to bring out a band on the stage. And this is because of my new CD, Street Parade, is written for horns and drums and voice. And so, naturally, I want to present that to the Jazz Fest audience.
For more information about Teresa Anderson, go to wwno.org or nolavie.com. For WWNO, I'm Sharon Litwin. Sorry.
There is also Teresa Anderson information about her nightly performances during this year's Jazz Fest at teresaanderson.com. And we're happy to bring you some as well here on All Things New Orleans. Let's change speeds. Let's change eras. Amid all the Jazz Fest excitement this time of year, there's a different kind of music being made, which also has a very, very long, perhaps longer tradition. WWNO's Farrar Hudkins has more.
On Sunday afternoon at Loyola University, Lyrica Baroque, a chamber ensemble specializing in music from the late 17th and early 18th centuries, will perform a program of favorites from that era. As oboist Jaron Filio explains, the group is expanding both its size and its repertoire for this concert.
Lyrica Baroque is a quintet with an oboe, violin, cellist, and harpsichordist. The violinist is Joseph Meyer. He's the concertmaster of the LPO. He asked me to play a concert with him 3 years ago. It was the two of us and a harpsichordist, and we did an all-baroque program. And I really enjoyed playing with him and playing that music, and I thought about it, and for me, as an oboist, the best chamber music written are Bach cantatas. So I talked to Joe and I said, what if we expanded the group and included a singer and also a cellist? And he thought it was a really good idea. And so we asked two musicians to join us from Houston. One is the cellist, Barry Sills. He is a Baroque specialist. And also the harpsichordist, Molly Hammond. She's also from Houston, and she also specializes in Baroque. Because I was really interested in not only getting to know the repertoire more, but also learning more about the style of Baroque. And I asked Sarah Jane McMahon if she would be interested in singing with us.
And Sarah Jane McMahon happily accepted the invitation.
Sharon just approached me after one of the operas. I had just sung Pamina in the Magic Flute with New Orleans Opera, and there was a party afterwards, and she said, you know, we're thinking about forming this Baroque chamber ensemble, and I don't know if you sing Baroque music or if that would be of interest to you. And I was thrilled because I actually kind of started my career with Baroque music. The first leading role I had at New York City Opera was Galatea in Handel's Acis and Galatea. I feel like it suits my voice well, and I just love the music. So it was kind of like a dream come true to be asked to be in a group like this. I'm going to be singing four arias. Three of them are by Handel, and they're opera arias. One of them is by Bach, and it's from his wedding cantata. I've never sung the wedding cantata before, and I don't know why I haven't, because it's such beautiful music. And we sang parts of it for our concert last May. Our program's all Bach and Handel. We're going to do a Handel Trio Sonata for oboe and violin and cello. Joe Meyer is going to be playing a Bach sonata. There's going to be a harpsichord solo piece and then a solo cello piece also.
McMahon says that the word Baroque may sound foreign, but the music is not.
Actually, it's a lot of things you've heard. You know, if you've ever been to a wedding, you've heard Baroque music. The first one I'm going to be singing, the title is Amor e Pavento from Handel's Orlando and Giangiaro from Giulio Cesare. And then the third one is Lascia ch'io pianga from Rinaldo. And you probably will be familiar with that one just from commercials. You know, it's one of these very familiar tunes. I'm really excited about the concert. It's something I've been looking forward to for months. And I'm happy to be home performing, but I'm also happy to be home performing this music. It's very rewarding.
Lyrica Baroque performs Bach and Handel Sunday, May 6th at 3 p.m. at Loyola University's Roussel Hall. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Farrar Hudgens.
Farrar is classical music manager here at WWNO. And I'm Jack Hopke with you, your host for All Things New Orleans each Thursday evening at 6:35. Glad you could join us here on this 3rd of May. Now, back to the stage. Well, in a way. By the time native New Orleanian Lillian Hellman died in 1984, her reputation as America's foremost female playwright of the 20th century had been obscured by charges that she was instead America's foremost literary liar, specifically in the memoirs Pentimento and Scoundrel Time. In a new biography of Hellman called A Difficult Woman, renowned historian Alice Kessler Harris explores Hellman's daring life and her vexed legacy. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Difficult is probably the most tactful word one could use in characterizing Lillian Hellman. If ever there were an author safer to meet through her art rather than in real life, she was the one. Born in New Orleans into a Jewish family, Hellman came of age in the Roaring Twenties, liberated by flappers and Freud. Hellman drank like a fish, swore like a sailor, and slept around like, well, like most of the men in her literary circle, chief among them Dashiell Hammett, with whom she had an open relationship spanning three decades. She was, recalled one observer, a tough broad, the kind of girl who can take the tops off bottles with her teeth. Hellman acted like one of the boys in other ways, too. She was self-supporting and unapologetic about being paid what she thought she was worth. She even haggled over the use of her plays by high schools and charitable organizations. Hellman threw herself into the tough political battles of her time, actively supporting the Spanish loyalists, joining the Communist Party, although she was evasive about her membership, and standing up to McCarthyism. Hellman was the most famous American woman playwright of the 20th century, a celebrity that was vastly extended when she began publishing her memoirs. She was an icon for women of my generation, coming to feminist consciousness in the 1970s. These days, though, when I teach Scoundrel Time, Hellman's memoir about her appearance before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, I have to tell my students who Lillian Hellman was. Usually, none of them have ever heard of her. The eminent historian Alice Kessler Harris has had that same disconcerting experience, so she decided to write a biography of Hellman, in part to figure out why she's been so deeply obscured. If Hellman is remembered at all, Kessler Harris says, she's remembered negatively. Fellow writer Mary McCarthy prematurely and effectively closed the coffin lid on Hellman's legacy when she appeared on the Dick Cavett Show in 1979 and famously pronounced about Hellman that every word she writes is a lie, including and the. Kessler Harris emphasizes to her readers that this biography of Hellman, called A Difficult Woman, is an historical rather than a literary or psychological excursion. Although she concedes that Lillian Hellman is a juicy character whose life is filled with sex and scandal, Kessler Harris mostly trains her gaze on the larger arguments over Stalinism and Hellman's art and her truth-telling or lack thereof. Kessler Harris wants to delve into how Hellman was formed by her time and perhaps misremembered by our own. The result is a biography that's substantive, measured, and a tad flat. Had Hellman the playwright gotten a preview of this biography, she might have advised Kessler Harris to punch it up a bit, to not shy away so much from the melodramatic nitty-gritty details of her subject's messy life. Regardless of whatever audience Kessler Harris hoped to reach, this is a biography for those who are already caught up in the contradictions of Lillian Hellman. It's unlikely to jumpstart interest in the uninitiated. But here's one good reason for why young women, especially, should care about the lessons offered by Hellman's life. Hellman, Kessler Harris emphasizes, continued to be a bold creature of the 1920s, long after Betty Boop became domesticated into June Cleaver. She paid dearly for that disorderly conduct. Kessler Harris does a superb job of showing how gendered, even misogynist, the criticisms of Hellman's art and politics were. William F. Buckley mocked the notion that Hellman was the greatest woman playwright, saying that that was the same as talking about the downhill champion on the one-legged ski team. Other critics derided her gutsiness as butch and made fun of her big nose and rattled skin. All her money and all her celebrity couldn't protect Hellman from being damned for the original sin of being a homely woman who was nonetheless sexual. My students, despite being so obsessed themselves with the concept of hotness, would probably say that things have changed. Hellman, wherever she is having a good snort over that one.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Difficult Woman by Alice Kessler Harris here on All Things New Orleans. To read an excerpt from the book, you can visit freshair.npr.org. And to hear our features again anytime or research archived articles from All Things New Orleans, visit wwno.org. Well, that's it for All Things New Orleans for another Thursday, this specifically the 3rd of May. I hope you've enjoyed soaking up some of our distinctive New Orleans culture. Remaining local and in the diaspora as well, I'm Jack Hoskey. Paul Mawson and Thomas Walsh also on the production staff of ATNO each week. Thanks also to WWNO classical music manager Farrah Hudkins and all our contributors. We'll be back on the 9th. We hope you join us. Support comes from Poydras Home, a retirement community in Uptown New Orleans for men and women over 60, offering independent living, assisted in nursing care, memory care, and an adult day program. Information at 897-0535 or online at poydrashome.com. Fresh Air is next at 7 p.m.